Now, more compelling talk radio, 1320 WILS, is live and Lansing with Michael Cohen and the Capital City Recap.
Good evening. It is Thursday. I'm Michael Cohen, producer Solomon Martin, and this is 1320 WILS. Tonight, we will talk about net neutrality. You know, yesterday, Facebook, Twitter, Google, dozens of major technology companies protesting these proposed changes to the U.S. net neutrality rules. We'll find out why they're so upset and if you should be too. Also, Governor Snyder now signing into law the new law against female genital mutilation. 15 years in prison for anyone involved. We'll hear from a survivor of FGM. Let's begin, though, with something that really should be on the news everywhere. Apparently, Trump and Russia seems to be the fixation, but ISIS reportedly admitting this week that their leader, al-Baghdadi, was in fact killed in an airstrike. What could this really mean to ISIS and to our battle against ISIS? Bruce Klingner is with us. He's a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Bruce, thank you for joining us on WILS.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Does our government officially believe that he is dead?
I'm sorry, I'm a North Korea guy.
Ah, all right, okay. You know what, let's turn it to North Korea then. I mean, whether it's ISIS or North Korea, we're in deep trouble either way. Hey, Bruce, tell me this. First of all, you've been studying North Korea for decades, right? You were the CIA's deputy division chief for Korea back in the late 90s. So are we in really more danger now than we were in the late 90s?
Yeah, North Korea has been continuing to develop its nuclear weapons as well as the missile means to deliver them. And especially in the last 2 years, they've really gone on a spree of missile launches. Mm-hmm. And that's both testing developmental missiles that are, still on their way to deployment, but also really not testing, but exercising the missiles that are already deployed, which would be part of a North Korea war plan to take over South Korea. So, okay. What people saw most recently was on July 4th, the ICBM test. And that was the first test of this missile, and it was successful. And it was fired in an unusually high trajectory, so it wouldn't fly over Japan. But had it been fired at a normal trajectory, it would have gone at least 7,000 kilometers. That's, in excess of the definition of an ICBM, and would have ranged all of Alaska. Right. But it's likely that that missile can go even further.
So, I mean, they've wanted to destroy us for decades, right? Why are they suddenly now so agitated?
Well, it's really... this is the culmination of a very long developmental program. They've been working for decades on various components of this. So they've had five nuclear tests. They did two last year. We're expecting another one. So that's refining their nuclear arsenal. Mm-hmm. And they've got missiles that can range Japan and South Korea as well as our bases in Guam. And then now they're working on continuing to work on the ICBM.
Okay, you're saying they're making steady progress then. This has just been a goal all along, and now they're actually about to attain it?
Exactly. When I was at the CIA in 1999, we did an unclassified national intelligence estimate that predicted North Korea would have a ICBM capability by 2015. So mm-hmm. I think we're a couple years off on the timing, but it's something that we've been long predicting will happen. It's just a matter of when they complete that that capability.
Okay. If you could go back to 99, is there anything that could have been done back then to change what we're seeing now?
Well, we could have not been pulling our punches on sanctions and targeted financial measures. Really, the sort of these smart sanctions came into being really kind of after the 9/11 attack, where they came up with new ways to go after the finances of terrorist groups, rogue regimes, mm-hmm. And criminal organizations. So it's something that's been developed, but. I think we would have stood a better chance had we been going after North Korea's finances more fully than we have been.
Really? And you think sanctions on their own would have stopped North Korea?
Well, it certainly is a determined foe that clearly are determined to have this, but at least I think we would have been in a better position now. Mm-hmm. I mean, even today we're still pulling our punches on things that we can do using U.S. laws. We've imposed, for example, $12 billion in fines on European banks for money laundering for Iran. We haven't imposed a single penny of fines on Chinese banks for money laundering for North Korea. The Trump administration finally sanctioned at least one Chinese bank. That's the first in 10 years, and yet we know there's evidence, even from unclassified means, of additional Chinese banks and businesses that are engaging with North Korea.
Okay, and you think the sanctioning the Chinese banks, that's the game changer then?
Well, I don't know if anything's a game changer, but what it is they are using the U.S. financial system for money laundering and other criminal activities. So the question would be, why wouldn't you enforce our law? Why would you give immunity to criminal organizations simply because they're Chinese?
Okay. So, in your view, is why is that? I mean, why are we being so light-handed here?
I guess it has been, you know, a concern or fear of how China will react. But what we need to do is divorce sort of diplomacy from law enforcement. We say, look, these are organizations which are misusing the U.S. financial system. They're entering U.S. banks, and you know they're doing illicit activity. So China, you know, we will enforce our laws regardless of the ethnicity or nationality of the criminal organization. And if China reacts, then one would wonder, why are they defending criminal groups?
Talking to Bruce Klingner with the Heritage Foundation, he's really one of the country's top experts on North Korea and what we're facing there. What do you think is going to end up happening with North Korea ultimately?
Well, it all depends on what sort of the policies are. And right now we also have questions about the new South Korean president. He, I think, inherently wants to engage with North Korea at a lower conditionality than the rest of the world does. But in the run-up to the summit and then the summit meeting itself with President Trump, he has been, I think, adopting more of the international consensus on the need for pressuring North Korea. Mm-hmm. So we hope he maintains that. And the concern is that North Korea will just continue developing these capabilities. So we also have to have sufficient defenses for ourselves and our allies to defend against really the spectrum of the North Korean military threat, not just the missiles and the nukes, but also biological and chemical weapons. They've got a million-man army close to the DMZ with South Korea. So you know, we have to ensure we have sufficient military forces and you know, demonstrate resolve to deter and, if necessary, defend and defeat the enemy.
Yeah. Do you really believe we could have a realistic military conflict with North Korea where they launch some kind of major attack on South Korea, for example?
Well, I mean, they did in 1950, and since then they've engaged in more tactical-level deadly attacks on U.S. and South Korean personnel. When Kim Jong-un came into office or into power, he directed his military to come up with a new war plan to be able to occupy the peninsula within 7 days, which would require them to go nuclear early. So whether he intends to use that plan or not, at least he wants the option.
Yeah. What's his calculation? He's a young guy. Why do you think he's so driven to be this aggressive?
Well, he's a product of his father and his grandfather who initiated all these programs. He seems to be even more aggressive in trying to carry them out. Just this year alone, he's had more missile tests and launches than his father and grandfather did combined in all of their years of power. So he really seems pushing the envelope. He's really trying to get not only the nuclear, but also many missile programs to fruition.
Does it make sense to you why, though? I mean, does he feel threatened in a way his grandfather and father were not? Or?
Well, he's really a continuation. He's a chip off the old block. The North Korea justifies their nuclear weapons as a response to the U.S. hostile policy. We say, well, we have forces in South Korea because of their invasion in 1950 and their continued development of capabilities and continued threats to turn Seoul and Tokyo and Washington into a sea of fire. It's sort of like, you know, a policeman is in a bad neighborhood in order to respond to, you know, any further actions by, you know, a bad guy. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, it's the presence of the policemen which are causing them to do bad things. So we obviously have a difference of view.
Okay. So is this a high alert moment for us now, or is it still not that close to a real serious military conflict?
Well, the thing with the Korean Peninsula is you're really always on the knife edge of a crisis, and that, as people have said, is a tactical situation can turn strategic in the blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. So there are certain times a year when there are higher tensions because of annual military exercises, which leads North Korea to increase its readiness and its threats. So in April, things were getting a bit tense, particularly since the Trump administration was saying things like, you know, our military attack on Syria was a signal to North Korea that we may do the same thing to them. So things were getting a bit dicey in April when, you know, we were wondering with whether the U.S. would initiate something.
Bruce Klingner, he's a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, specializing in Korean and Japanese affairs, formerly worked at the CIA as the deputy division chief for Korea. Bruce, great to have you on WILS. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thanks very much for having me.
Yep.